Well, I'd like to weigh in on being one of the people up here who had something to say, and I'll tell you what I would tell that little girl. I'd say that to that little girl, Easter is a day when the most loving, perfect, and pure guy who ever walked the face of the earth died a brutal death and came back real deal in the flesh 3 days later. Now, I would be in the minority. In fact, I'm kind of bummed. I'm probably in the minority of people in my profession. Wall Street Journal just a couple days ago ran an article on redefining God, in which they were very accurately depicting what's taking place in many religious institutions across our country. And here's one of the quotes they had right in the beginning here. This Sunday, rather than dwelling on the risen Christ, the traditional Easter sermon topic, the Reverend David Aslison says he plans to compare God to a gardener in order to appease the growing theological diversity at a small Methodist church. I don't want anyone to feel left out, he says. Now, when someone says that, I say, man, that is a great moderate statement. Moderate, that's a popular word in America today. We like moderates. We like our politicians to be moderates. We like our religions to be moderates. We like our neighbors to be moderates. Because when someone is a moderate, they're not going to bug us. They're not going to offend us. Now, on certain issues, I'm moderate, and certain issues, I'm passionate. And I have to say that I like being moderate on some issues, because when I'm moderate on an issue, I don't have to stand up. I don't have to stand up and be counted. Sometimes I'm moderate because I don't have all the facts. Sometimes something just doesn't feel right internally. But I know there are times when I have to say I have to stand up because this is right and this is where I am. And this series is birthed to help us take a stand. Help us take a stand to get away from a lot of wishy-washy God spiritual language. And we can walk out of here today, after being here for 3 weeks, say, you know what? I don't need to be a moderate thing on this Jesus anymore. I can walk out of here and say, he was just a normal guy. I have all the information I have. Or we can walk out of here today and some of us are going to go, wow, my world is rocked. My world is rocked. He wasn't just another good guy. He was God. And this changes everything. It's the classic moderate statement for a person in America today is that Jesus was a good man, or Jesus was a great prophet. And both these statements, just about everybody can agree with them. And there's nothing really false about those statements. They're moderate statements. You can make those statements without having read the Bible. You can read those statements without ever having gone to a church. You can read those statements without having read any literature that challenges you whatsoever. Napoleon Bonaparte was not a moderate. And here's what he said about Jesus. He said, everything in Christ astonishes me. His spirit overawes me and his will confounds me. One can absolutely find nowhere but in him alone the imitation or example of his life. I search in vain in history to find the similar to Jesus Christ or anything which can approach the gospel. Neither history, nor humanity, nor the ages, nor nature offer me anything with which I am able to compare it or explain it. Here, everything is extraordinary. And we're wrestling with who Jesus is in this room. We're wrestling with who he is. And I want to look at a story from Jesus' life of somebody else who was wrestling with who he was. The guy by the name of Nicodemus. Nicodemus was a smart cookie. He was far from a moderate back in those days. In fact, he would have been labeled a religious extremist. He was a Pharisee. He had vast portions of the scriptures memorized. He had detailed ways in which he lived his life. It altered his schedule. It altered his weekends. It altered how he dressed. He was out there. He was hardcore committed. But he starts learning about this guy named Jesus. He starts hearing him speak. And he realized, man, this guy has a power when he speaks like none other I've ever heard. There's something unique about this guy. He noticed him in terms of how he interacted with the hurting. And he said, wow, this guy has a heart for the hurting like I have never ever seen before. He notices that Jesus has power to bear in affecting people's lives, and he says, wow, this guy has the ability to do the miraculous and the unfathomable like nobody I've ever met before. I need to get with this guy. I need to talk with him. He starts the seeking process, and the way he starts the seeking process is very similar to the way many of us start the seeking process. He wants to do it in anonymity. He goes under the cover of darkness to see Jesus. Some of us are like that. We're in the seeking process. We're trying to figure out who Jesus is. And we don't really want a lot of people to know what we're doing. So, you know, we'll maybe not tell people we're going to that weird church that meets up in the hill in a middle school. We'll kind of come in and make sure we park our car a couple blocks away so no one sees our car anywhere near here. You know, we walk in, we're like, man, I need a safe place just to figure out what's going on here. And this is what happens in Nicodemus. He goes to a safe place under cover of darkness, but he hears a very dangerous message. Very dangerous. Let's look what happens. He came to Jesus at night and said, Rabbi, we know you're a teacher who's come from God, for no one could perform the miraculous signs you're doing if God were not with him. Now, this is a modern way of saying, Jesus, I know you're a really good guy. Hey, you're a teacher who's come from God. That was just a way of saying, hey, you're a teacher that teaches things that God would have people teach. It's a moderate statement. Anybody could agree that Jesus is that. Anybody is. So Jesus looks and hears what Nicodemus is saying, and Jesus does not want to hear this at all. He knows that Nicodemus is trying to take a middle-of-the-road statement, and Jesus knows that Nicodemus needs to come to closure. He needs to come to closure. So here's what he says right after that. Jesus declared, I tell you the truth. No one can see the kingdom of God unless he's born again. How can a man be born when he's old? Nicodemus asked. Surely he cannot enter a second time into his mother's womb to be born. Now we have a hard time understanding this passage because of two words. There's two words in this passage that are bumming people out. Go ahead and whisper them right beside somebody. What two words are bumming you out in this? Good. What are they? Yeah. Born again. Born again. Those two words bum us out. We hear the words born again. We think things like save the whales. We think Jerry Falwell. We think Pat Robertson. We think Billy Graham. We think bombing abortion clinics. We think all kinds of different things that conjure up negative emotions within us. So when we read something like this, we have a vested interest to not understand and to not like what Jesus was saying. But understand that Nicodemus didn't have any of this cultural baggage. He had none of this cultural baggage. He was able to take Jesus' words at face value for what he meant. Some people ask me, hey, is Crossroads one of those born-again churches? I say, well, you know, I don't know. Culturally speaking, depends what you mean by the cultural word. Maybe not. But in terms of how Jesus used it, yeah. Yeah. Jesus goes right to the heart of the matter. He looks at Nicodemus and says, hey, Nicodemus, I know you think you got it all figured out. I know you think you know the scriptures real well. I know you think you're a real holy guy. But let me tell you, you need to start from scratch, Jack. You got it all wrong. You got it all wrong. You got to be born again. You need a new heart. You need a new attitude. You need a new perspective. You need a new spirit. You need a new relationship with God because you ain't got it. You don't have it. Now, Nicodemus understands that Jesus is not speaking literally about being born again. Nicodemus is a very, very smart guy. He knows he's speaking figuratively. So Nicodemus comes back with a very figurative statement. He says, surely, can't enter a second time into his mother's womb to be born. He's not saying, hey, Jesus, how am I supposed to crawl back up in there? I'm a little bigger now than I was, than I was 62 years ago. What he's saying is this, Jesus, man, I'm an old guy. I've been around the block. I've been schooled. I have my values. I have my personal truth. I have my way in which I want to see the world. I have my perceptions. I have my reality. You know, what's right for you is what's right for you. What's right for me is what's right for me. How do you expect me to just wash that all away and go back to square one? See, Nicodemus doesn't like what he's hearing. Jesus says, the heart of the matter is this. You don't have it right. The heart of the matter is this. You need a fresh relationship with God. God has to do something in your heart. How many of you had a choice in being born? Do I have a choice in that? I never did. I was just born. One day I'm nice and warm and all of a sudden, wham! I'm out in cold stuff. I didn't have any choice. Boom! It just happened. And that's like a relationship with God. That's like a relationship with God. Something just happens. There's just this gnaw internally. There's this thing that gets you on the seeking process. One day you're just thinking life is grand. The next day you're going, man, there must be more to life than this. There must be. Jesus then goes on to illustrate how someone would go about getting a new heart, how someone would go about getting a new life, how someone would go about getting a new attitude, a fresh relationship with God. And he tells Nicodemus a story that he's very, very aware of. It took place in the Old Testament. He tells him a story. And the story was that The Israelites were a bunch of whiners, oftentimes. The Jews were a bunch of whiners. They were always complaining. They weren't honoring God. And God, over and over again, he would get really fed up and he would get really, really angry. And so what happened one day was God said, "That's it. I'm sick of it." And my wife would say, "I'm sick of it. I'm sick of it. That's it. You're done. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to send down some snakes, and they're going to start biting on you. They're going to start biting on you and chomping on you and, you know, putting venom inside of you." And he goes to Moses and says, "Here, Moses, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go and I want you to get a staff, and I want you to get a bronze snake, and I want you to wrap a bronze snake around that staff, and I want you to plant it in the middle of the compound. And I want you to do this before I send these snakes down. As soon as you have that ready, I'm going to send these snakes down the compound. I'm going to have them start biting on people. And you just tell people when they get bit to turn around and look at that staff and they'll be healed." And what God was trying to do was trying to teach the Israelites a few lessons. Number one was, don't mess with me. I'm tired of your whining. That was number one. Number two was, when you get hurt, when you're afflicted, when you aren't right, I have the cure. I have the answer. Look to me. He was teaching his people to depend on him. So whenever someone would get bit, they would turn around and stare at this. And they would be healed. You ever see this before? This is one of the many parts of American culture. It's rooted back in the Bible. This is the symbol for the American Medical Association. And it traces back to this Old Testament story of healing. And Nicodemus was very, very well aware of this story. Probably had this story memorized. So here's what Jesus says. He continues on. He says, "Just as Moses lifted up the snake in the desert, so the Son of Man must be lifted up, that everyone who believes in him may have eternal life. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son. Whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have eternal life. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through him." Jesus says, "Nicodemus, I'm going to be lifted up on a pole." Nicodemus didn't fully understand everything that Jesus was saying at this point, but this is what Jesus was saying. Saying just like there was a pole, and there was a snake on a pole, and people had to look to that pole in order to get healed, I'm going to get lifted up and on a pole. I'm going to be put to a tree. I'm going to be nailed to a cross. I'm going to be nailed to it. And I'm going to be the focal point for all humanity. And when people are hurting, when people are disjointed with God, as all people are, when people are out of God's will, when people are offending him, when God is angry with people and there's a sense of justice taking place, people need to look at me. People need to look at me hanging on the cross. I'm going to be lifted on a pole. That's my purpose. That's my mission statement. My mission statement is to come and to live a perfect, pure, sinless life as only God can come. At the end of that life, I'm going to be nailed like a snake. Like a sinful snake. I'm going to be nailed to that tree. And my mission is to get people to look at that and receive me and start a new birth, a new beginning, where everything changes. Everything. It says, "Nicodemus, can't you understand? It's not about you. It's not about you memorizing this, and it's not about you doing this and doing that and pulling yourself up by the bootstraps like other world religions do. It's about me. It's not about you. It's about me. I am the focal point. My life is the focal point, the fulcrum for world history and your potential spiritual history." Now, a couple things about this idea of Jesus being a good man. A few things I want to have you think about. Number one is this: a good man doesn't die an unnecessary death. Now, some of you might call me a good man. Hopefully, a lot of you would call me a nice guy. True confessions. I probably wouldn't die for a single one of you. Maybe I would. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'd have a blast of adrenaline sometime in a certain situation, but in all likelihood, I probably would not die for you. Good guys don't go around dying for people. There's a lot of good people are not going to lay down their life and go through a brutal, brutal death if they have anything to do with it. If Jesus had any sense that his mission was to be a good guy, that his mission was to be a good prophet, that his mission was to be a great teacher, then he wouldn't have had to sacrificially lay down his life. You know, there came a time when he was laid on his back, spread out to a cross, when there were nails that were put to his wrists. And if I was him, as soon as that hammer went back to this, I go, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, wait, 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 whoa, 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 whoa there. I'm sorry. Did you think I said I was God? No, 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 no. I'm not God. No, no. Did you think I said I was the king of the Jews? No, no, I'm not. No, I'm not king. I'm just a good teacher. I'm just trying to give people seven principles to a better marriage. That's all I'm doing. No. The disciples, they had it all wrong. They put me up to this. All of a sudden, I'm thinking clearly now, and this is not a good Friday. And no, this is no. I'm just not that. A good man does not do that. Now, if you don't think Jesus was God, I'll tell you what you can say that is more accurate. You could say Jesus was a crazy guy. You could say that. That is a rational conclusion. Jesus was a lunatic. He was a nutcase. You know, he had such a low ego that he wanted people to follow him, and he knew that people would worship him for 2,000 years if he went through the sacrificial death. A crazy guy would do that. A crazy guy would allow himself to be killed for something that wasn't true, simply get strokes, simply because he was deluded and didn't understand reality. He could be crazy. He could be. But a good guy? No. A good guy doesn't do that. But there are groups of people who are trying to purport the good guy agenda. Groups of people that are trying to convince you and I that there's nothing special about Jesus, nothing divine about Jesus, nothing incredible about Jesus that you and I can't have and that you and I already aren't. And these groups get all the great airplay today. And one of the big groups is called the Jesus Seminar. It consists of 50 people who meet once a year, and they critique the Bible, and they critique whether or not Jesus said what the Bible actually says that he said. They vote on these once a year, and the results are tallied up. And these are the people that are or people like this are the driving force for things like all the PBS specials we see, or Times Newsweek article this week, or Newsweek that week. And hey, here's what these scholars say, and therefore Jesus was just a good guy. He was just a sage. He was just a cynic. He was just a political figure. And if you look at the findings of these people, of these quote scholars, you'd say, man, it looks like they just say that he didn't say anything they don't like. That's not a stretch. Anything that challenges, no, he didn't say that. These scholars include people such as directors Martin Scorsese, Paul Verhoeven, director of Showgirls and Basic Instinct. I don't even know if a good guy would watch those movies. One scholar says this about this group. Dr. Timothy Johnson from Emory University: the Jesus Seminar follows a process that's biased against the authenticity of the gospel traditions, and its results were already determined ahead of time. This is not responsible or even critical scholarship. It's a self-indulgent charade. And people who are in this camp are the ones on the forefront of publishing books that Joseph Beth puts out, and they're on the most prime racks at the airport, that caused the average people to think that Jesus was just a good guy. One of these popular books recently was The Tomb of God by Andrews and Schellenberger. And they say that Jesus never died. They say that Jesus never came back from the dead. They say that there wasn't any resurrection. And the way in which they find what they called the solution to this 2,000-year-old mystery of finding the body of Jesus is that Jesus never rose from the dead. In fact, Jesus never died. He never, ever died. What happened was Jesus went into a deep coma. He came back to. Then he escaped with Mary Magdalene to France, where he lived a long life and died of old age. And he's buried in a hillside. You can go and see where he was buried. And people read this and go, oh, wow. Yeah, and guys like this going, Larry King and Gerardo Rivera and all that stuff. And, I just want to say this is the stuff that causes people to doubt the heart of the matter, that Jesus is actually God and did what the Bible says he was. So I want to camp out here for a little bit and talk about this for a moment. You remember Brian last week recounting all the archaeological evidence that are supporting the Bible? Remember that? Wasn't that fascinating? He could have gone for a whole series about how all these digs over in the Mideast are bringing up relics that are tied back to the Bible. Let me ask you this. What do you think happens if we go and we dig in that hillside in France? What do you think it happens? You think those authors want to go dig in that hill? What do you think? I say they don't find a body. That's what I say. And I say if they do find a body, I say it isn't Jesus' body. If they were to find the body of Jesus, it would have to have some marks of authenticity. This is one where we can go and say, okay, who are the experts on this stuff, and what do they say? Well, I would say the experts on whether or not somebody might be dead or not is a doctor. In fact, the Journal of the American Medical Association is the primo journal for doctors, and I think if they weighed in on this issue, I'd take that pretty seriously. And they did weigh in on this issue about a decade ago. Here's the preamble to one of their articles. It's our intent to present not a theological treatise, but rather a medically and historically accurate account of the physical death of the one called Jesus Christ. They said, hey, let's look at the evidence and let's figure out whether or not Jesus actually died. We can't say whether or not he rose from the dead, but let's just take a look at the evidence and figure out whether or not he actually died. If they go digging up on that hill in France, they'd have to find some remains of hands. They'd find hands that were tender hands. They'd find hands that were strong hands at one time as a carpenter. They'd find hands that caressed the cheeks of children. Don't put that up yet, please. They'd find hands that gestured powerfully during communication. They'd find hands that had a nail driven through the wrist 6 inches without having actually broken any bones. The Journal of the American Medical Association said, man, it would look kind of like this. Go through and start going through major nerve centers. It would be excruciating pain. Not only would they find hands where this kind of stuff was taking place, but they'd find feet. They'd find feet that walk from place to place, trying to bring a message of hope to people. They'd find feet that were tired after diligently carrying out his mission. They'd find feet that one time had such a massive impact on one woman that she wept and took her hair and dried the tears off of his feet. They'd find feet that had changed history. They'd find feet that had another 6-inch nail driven right between the two of them, like this. They'd find feet and hands that at one time were nailed to a cross, like that. They'd find feet and hands, feet put together, one nail driven all the way through them, hands wrenched out through the wrists. And they'd find that was the way that a guy hung and died. A brutal death, the most brutal death that mankind has ever invented. The cross. And if they were to find a body, they'd find a torso. They'd find a torso that at one point had a spear stuck into his side as he was on the cross. And the Bible says that blood and water came out of that side simultaneously. The Journal of American Medicine says clearly the weight of historical and medical evidence indicates that Jesus was dead before the wound to his side was inflicted, and probably supports the traditional view that the spear thrust between the right ribs probably perforated not only the right lung, but also the pericardium and heart, and thereby ensured his death. Accordingly, interpretations based on the assumption that Jesus did not die on the cross appear to be at odds with modern medical knowledge. They say, when water and blood comes out, you're dead. That is simply the way it is. What causes a guy to go through that? What kind of good guy would deal with that? What kind of good guy would have that kind of death? What would drive you to do something like that? Private Ryan is one of the most powerful movies I've ever seen. The premise behind the movie is Private James Ryan is behind enemy lines and all of his brothers have been killed on one day of battle. So the government sends out a party of Army Rangers to go out and get him and bring him back. And at the end of the movie, the climactic movie, one of the key figures, though I don't want to ruin the movie for you, but it was Tom Hanks and he was the sergeant, is dying. And he reaches up and he says to Private Ryan, after many people lost their lives for Private James, live differently. But Army Rangers get bummed out at that clip. Because that is not what an Army Ranger would say. You know the motto for an Army Ranger? Sua sponte. Sua sponte, which means of our own accord. Of our own accord. You see, all different kind of gods and all different world religions say earn this. They say, you do it, you deal with it, you get the brass ring, you work it out, keep growing, you're not good enough, go, 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 go. Jesus never said earn this. Jesus never said you better. Jesus says, hey, of my own accord, This is my mission. This is my deal. This is my calling. Whether or not you want to receive it or not, I'm doing it. I'm doing it because it's the right thing to do. And I love you so much and I care for you so much, I'm going to go through this of my own free accord. What kind of guy does that? What kind of guy does that? God, that's who does that. God. Second thing about a good guy, good man doesn't have the power to resurrect. Good man doesn't have the power to resurrect. When you have thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of cutting edge technology, the most cutting edge communication technology, manuscripts, thousands of years old, that say that Jesus came back from the dead, you have to deal with that somehow. We talked about that last week. You have to deal with it. You can't just say, "Oh, it didn't happen." When you have virtually no evidence that goes against it, you have to say, wait a minute, what took place there? There's some things we got to wrestle with. One thing we have to wrestle with is the presence of an empty tomb. There was an empty tomb. How did it get empty? There was an empty tomb. There was no doubt that something happened to Jesus' body. Nobody would doubt that. Something happened to Jesus' body. Because people back in those times had a vested interest in Jesus not coming back from the dead. Because they knew if Jesus came back from the dead, there would be a groundswell of support and all different kinds of things would happen. There was an empty tomb. There was an empty tomb. We have to somehow account for how that empty tomb got there. How did it get there? Nicodemus continued on in his search. We don't know exactly what happened with him in his relationship with Jesus or his interaction with Jesus, but he hung in there. He hung in there through an uncomfortable conversation. He hung in there. And later on, he actually is one of the people that takes Jesus' body and puts him in the tomb. And not only did Nicodemus stick around, but a bunch of people stuck around. There was a plethora of witnesses. Put another way, there was 500 witnesses. Or 500 witnesses. And there are thousands and thousands and thousands of sources that tell us that there are 500 witnesses. And not only were these people witnesses, they said, "Hey, I saw it," but they were passionate. They were passionate. There was Emperor Nero. It came not long after Jesus died. This guy had a problem. He had two problems. One problem was he didn't like Christians. He hated Christians. Second problem, he had a really nice garden that he couldn't enjoy at night. They said, "Wow, I'm going to kill two birds with one stone, and I'm going to take care of both these problems. I'm going to take Christians, and I'm going to impale them on poles, and I'm going to light them on fire so that I can then go and enjoy my garden." Now, let me ask you, if you didn't see Jesus come back from the dead, or if you didn't know somebody who was a trusted, credible source that saw it, would you be impaled and lit on fire? I wouldn't. I'm sorry. For a myth, for a good guy, for some religious symbolism, I wouldn't do that. And I'd say, if you are, you're nuts. You're crazy. You're nuts. You know, if they come back and they dig into that hillside, and they somehow have some technology that says, "Man, you know, Jesus is there. That's him. That day I hand in my resignation. And that day I'd send you all a letter saying, folks, don't you ever dare go to church again or ever read the Bible again. It's a sham." Because if Jesus didn't come back, didn't come back from the dead, he was just a normal guy, or he was a lunatic. He wasn't God. And all those people that were impaled and burned and all those other early martyrs knew that he came back. How do you account not just for the plethora of the witnesses, but for the passion of his followers? See, because a good man doesn't sacrifice himself. And a good man doesn't inspire people to sacrifice himself. We have people in this church that sacrifice themselves, makes huge sacrifices on a day-by-day, week-by-week basis. And they do it because they have a relationship with Christ. Because something took place on that cross, and then something took place inside that tomb that has altered their eternal trajectory, and they're just different. They're different. They've had a rebirth. They've had a new start. There's a freshness that other people will never understand until you've actually been born. During the presidency of Andrew Jackson, George Wilson, a postal clerk, robbed a federal payroll train, and in the process, he killed a guard. So he was sentenced to hang, death by being hung. But because of public sentiment against capital punishment, and because of some supporters that he had, they petitioned Andrew Jackson to try to get him to issue a pardon. And sure enough, Andrew Jackson issued a pardon to George Wilson. Now, what would you do if you received a pardon? I'd take it. Pretty simple. Well, for whatever reason, we don't know why, George Wilson rejected the pardon. He said, I don't want the pardon. Now the court system had a quandary. Oh no, what do we do? We never thought about someone who rejects a pardon before. So it had to go to the Supreme Court, and they had to figure out, what do we do with someone who's rejected a pardon? And Chief Justice John Marshall, at that time, has in the court documents the rendering on this. And here's what he says. A pardon is parchment whose only value must be determined by the receiver of the pardon. It has no value apart from that which the receiver gives to it. George Wilson has refused to accept the pardon. We cannot conceive why he would do so, but he has. Therefore, George Wilson must die. George Wilson, for punishment of his crime, was hanged. Pardon, declared the Supreme Court, didn't mean anything until somebody made the intentional decision to receive it. Didn't matter how powerful the person was who issued the pardon. Didn't matter anything. In the final analysis, somebody has to receive it and accept it and say, okay, I'll take that. And friends, that is exactly what took place on this cross. That is exactly what took place on this cross. This cross was when God exhibited justice. This cross took place because God is royally ticked with everybody in this room. If you think you're a good guy, you don't know God. You don't. You don't. Because as soon as you come to know God, you realize you're not a good guy compared to God. God is offended by the ways we sin. God is ticked that we don't want to follow Him. God is annoyed by our selfishness, annoyed by how we rationalize the things that we do wrong. Angers Him. It angers Him. And that's what this is all about. God unleashing His justice on a snake, someone who became a snake for a fraction of an instant. But that doesn't mean anything. That's a pardon for the rest of us. But it doesn't mean anything unless you make an intentional decision to receive it. It means nothing. You and I got to say, all right, God, the heart of the matter is this. I'm not right with You. The heart of the matter is this. I have problems. And the heart of the matter is I understand now who Jesus was and what He did. This changes everything. Right now, you might be feeling a little like twinge internally. You might be feeling a little gnaw. You might just have some thoughts going through your mind. You say, wow, I've never thought these thoughts before. You might be getting born right now. You might be getting born right now. Pardon's been issued, but you have to receive it. Why wouldn't you receive it? Why wouldn't you? This Easter, you can receive Christ. And at the heart of your life, everything changes. You can do it today. You can do it when you go home. You can do this next week. You can do this whenever. This needs to happen before death. And simply says, God, I get it. Something isn't right. I ask You to forgive me and come into my life. Heal me as only You can heal me. And that's a person who has a relationship with God. I want to close out this service by having you sit still and to think about who Jesus is. He has to be someone. And as soon as you come to that conclusion of who He is, you need to act on that. I'd like you to just sit and meditate on the song that we're going to close today with.